This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Scrappy Little Nobody by Anna Kendrick. Read by the author.
Author's note. That's me. I'm the author. I'm sure I've mixed up the timeline and contradicted myself, but I've tried to get it right. I've changed some names to protect the innocent and to protect my mother from people in her book club coming at her like, that's not how my kid remembers that day in preschool. A lot of things that are meaningful to me didn't make the cut because they just weren't entertaining. For example, my childhood best friend Meg isn't in the book at all because it turns out my mom was right. Those stories really are only funny to the two of us. Introduction. 1. Braid hair. 2. Arrange books by color. 3. Do homework on the floor. 4. Feng shui room. 5. Magazine collage. 6. Lie in yard with Walkman. When I was 13, I started making lists. I've always liked structure, and I thought if I broke it down into steps, I could will myself to fit in. My idea of normal came mainly from film and television, and with that as my guide, I wrote down the kind of things that a normal girl might be doing when a boy showed up unexpectedly at her house. Of course, the one time a boy showed up unexpectedly at my house, he found this list. Jared was one of the popular kids at school. We weren't close, but he was a neighbor, so he occasionally came by. This was the only time he'd ever arrived unannounced. He spotted my notebook, opened it, and started reading out loud. Oh, God, that's stupid. Seriously, put that down. It's nothing. I was in a full-out panic. Come on, Anna. Why would you generate written evidence of your social and emotional ineptitude and leave it lying around? As soon as he left, I ripped the pages out of my journal and burned them in the bathroom sink. The fire made the house stink of carbon for days. When my mom and dad came home, I told them I'd been burning incense. I doubt my parents believed me, but they could sense my desperate need to drop the issue, so they moved on. That night, I resolved to keep the crazy inside my head where it belonged, forever. But here's the thing about crazy. It wants out. Once I'd moved out of the house at 17, and there was less threat of unwanted guests pawing through my belongings, I attempted to keep a journal again. I managed only about a dozen entries over a period of 2 years, but I never did burn it. Last year, I found this journal. My handwriting as an angsty teen was appalling, yet somehow better than it is now. And the subject to which I devoted the most pages, besides my virginity, was the fear that I would fail in all things and have to go back home to Maine with my tail between my legs. I had thought my younger self assumed everything would work out, that I was possessed of some reckless confidence you only have in youth. Otherwise, how could I have been fool enough to try? But the journal wasn't quixotic, it was fearful. The terror was so present, yet I was doing it anyway. Shit, I thought. I used to be tough. I used to be brave. I used to be a better version of me. Lately, I can't paint my bedroom walls without asking 10 people for their opinion and eventually talking myself out of it altogether. I'd moved away from everything I knew and loved at 17 in spite of how scared I was. I wondered if I'd still have it in me to do something I found so daunting. Aren't you supposed to get more independent as you get older? Shouldn't I be bolder, more self-sufficient? Have I gotten comfortable? Have I stopped pushing myself the way I did when I was trying to make something of myself? Was that a fluke? I texted my brother. Me. I miss being a scrappy little nobody. I was much more capable. Mike. Dude. You're still scrappy. You just get a lot more emails now. P.S. You're still a little nobody to me. Footnote. Okay, he didn't actually say that last part, but it would have been perfect if he did. As if I had asked the universe to send me an example of something intimidating, a test to see if I still had some nerve, the opportunity arose to write a book. Sure, it will be hard, but all you need to be a writer is perseverance, a low-level alcohol dependency, and a questionable moral compass. Is that not what you need? Well, I've got a bunch of embarrassing stories, and I'll keep the rest of that stuff in my back pocket. Thanks to my old friend Jared, I'm a pretty private person. I never let anyone, not even friends, into my bedroom or my purse. I have a small stroke anytime someone asks to use my laptop. I only use that thing to look for porn and the definitions of words I should already know. Yet I've chosen to commit intimate details of my life and psyche to the page. So step into my brain, kids! I wish I could have called this, "It's Not That Serious," or a tweet, but longer. So much significance is placed on something you put in a book, and I don't care much for significance. Let's agree now that we're just having a conversation, and I happen to talk more than I listen. True in real life as well. I tend to spew my opinions until someone interrupts me, and weirdly, my computer never gained sentience to save me from myself. There were actually several stories that my mother specifically asked me to include. Mostly those rare instances in which I did something out of generosity or love or some other motivation found in emotionally normative humans. I suspect she worries I'm too abrasive and wants me to provide some indication that I'm not a terrible person. Alas, I've tried to be honest, because honesty makes me feel less alone, and I hope you're entertained. Maybe I should have learned my lesson about written evidence. It's possible that in 10 years every word in here will send me into fits of humiliated paralysis. But the crazy wants out. Let's sue this. A few disclaimers. I'm not cool. Jessica was the first person to mistake me for someone cool. When I was in kindergarten, both of my parents worked full-time, so I went to an after-school program. Every day, a van picked up a few kids from my class and made stops at local schools around the city before driving us to the YMCA in downtown Portland, Maine. I had recently discovered, thanks to an incident my mother and father just loved to recount, that I did not make a good first impression. Over the summer, we'd been to a family campground, and while other children met and became immediate playmates, that power evaded me. I sulked for the better part of a week and eventually asked my parents, "Will you find me a friend? I don't get why that's so funny. That's basically how I feel as an adult. Will one of you guys find me a friend?" When we picked up Jessica from her school, she marched to the very back of the van, one row behind me, and tapped me on the shoulder. For a 5-year-old, she was a deeply confident girl. Jessica was ready to judge her fellow passengers. "Are you friends with anyone else here?" she asked. My animal instincts knew that she was the alpha, and that I needed to think fast to impress her. "Oh," I said. "Dan, in the front seat, I know him." I'd known Dan since 8 o'clock that morning, but admitting I was friendless seemed like it would be worse than lying, so I took the risk. Then I had a terrifying thought. What if she talks to Dan next? I continued. "I know Dan, but," I leaned in, "he's kind of weird." "Oh," she nodded her head in recognition. Being judgmental was really taking me places. She narrowed her eyes. "We won't play with him." "If you say so, Jessica, your alpha energy is making me feel alive." More kids got in the van, and Jessica made her assessments swiftly. By the time we arrived, she had curated a small group of girls she deemed worthy and said, "We're going to play together. We're the Cool Kids Club." "Hold up, Jess. I'm in the Cool Kids Club?" I was 5 years old, but I already knew that wasn't right. "Just hang in there, Kendrick. Don't mess this up." The group decided we'd officially call ourselves the Cool Kids Club. Since kindergartners are so pressed for time, we decided to just use the initials. And since kindergartners are excellent at spelling, we called ourselves the KKK. When I proudly announced my new affiliation to my mother, she scrambled to explain that neither cool nor club starts with K, but I'd seen billboards for cool cigarettes, so she wasn't fooling me. The next day, during outside playtime at the Y, Jessica walked straight up to Dan and yelled, "We're not going to play with you!" She stomped off dramatically and took the rest of the girls with her. "What the hell was that, Jessica? I said the kid was kind of weird. I didn't say he dismembered cats. You were only supposed to avoid him long enough that I wouldn't be caught in my lie." Jessica became my first enemy. Like most enemies in my life, I hoped to punish her with passive-aggressive glances and silent but passionate resentment. She retaliated by forgetting I existed. Ah, the moral victory. I am a very, very small weirdo. First grade was when I realized I was small. I was the smallest, youngest-looking child in every group, no matter the situation. In fact, this is something to bear in mind as we go. Whatever age I am in a given story, subtract 3 or 4 years, and that's what I looked like. Footnote, except when I was born. My God, I was so fat. I almost killed my mother. And while that's gross, it's completely true. If we lived in a time before cesarean sections, she legit wouldn't have survived. I would also like to thank cesarean sections for sparing me the mental anguish of knowing I once passed through my mother's vaginal canal. We were learning about outer space, and our teacher brought in a chart that told us what we would weigh on all the different planets. We were so excited to find out how crazy heavy we'd be on Jupiter or how crazy light we'd be on Pluto. My weight wasn't listed. It became clear I didn't make the cut because there was no calculation for what I would weigh on Pluto. I would weigh nothing, less than nothing. I would drift into space. Oh, man. I wasn't just the smallest one in the class. I was a freak. There was no metric for how deformed I was. It was one thing to be the chihuahua in a group of Labradors. It was quite another to be the hamster. That night, I cried to my mother, who assured me that she'd been small at my age, too. Wow, that really doesn't help me right now, Mom. When I calmed down, I saw her point. She'd turned out fine. She wasn't living in a special community for the physically repulsive. So I decided I could go back to school the next day. Even adults thought I was younger than I was. This made me extra sensitive, and though they may have meant well, I became one of those little kids who didn't enjoy grown-ups fucking with me. One summer, a Russian wrestling team came through my hometown. My dad had been a wrestler in college, and I believe he was a bit starstruck. He took me to watch their first match, and after letting me play imagination under the bleachers for a few hours, he pushed me at the imposing coach, an absolute caricature of a man. The coach eyed me and asked, "What's your name, little girl?" "Anna." "Anya!" "Foreigners," I stewed. "No," I spoke more slowly this time. "Anna." "Yes, Anya." "Oh, this motherfucker thinks this is cute," I realized. "He thinks we're playing a little game." "It's Anna," I said, and I put on my most fearsome face. "Aw, Anya." He reached down and ruffled my hair. I snapped my head around to face my dad. "Are you going to let him get away with this? This is the name of your beloved mother, may she rest in peace, which means that this man, this Ruski, is making a mockery of your flesh and blood twofold." He noticed that I was on the verge of a tantrum and picked me up. "I think she's a little tired." "Oh, is that right?" And so I saw. I was going to have to fight and claw to be taken seriously in this life, and probably never quite succeed. I still try to be serious, but apathy has become a part of me now in a way that my 6-year-old self couldn't have foreseen. I've never been able to muster the righteous indignation of my elementary school years. Back at school, I tried to embrace the smallest things in every category. Favorite instrument in the orchestra? The piccolo. Favorite mammal? The shrew. Favorite country? Monaco. And my favorite planet? Pluto. Screw you, Neil deGrasse Tyson. Always being the smallest also gave me a specific role in life. It gave me an identity. Lining up by height? Excuse me while I give you a starting point. Gymnastics day in gym class? I'll prepare myself to be thrown. On one family cleaning day, my dad bought an extendable duster to clean under low tables, and I lost my mind because I thought I no longer had a purpose in the family. He threw away the duster and went back to letting me do a mediocre job crawling under the furniture. First grade led to other discoveries, too. I was small, I was loud, I had ratty hair, but I suspected something deeper was wrong. One day, I tried to articulate this suspicion to my mother. It's like I have a different heart. The other girls have one kind of heart, and I have a different kind. My mom was understandably confused. Are you saying they're mean? No, I don't know. Saying other kids were mean felt like I was saying I was more kind, which definitely wasn't it. More anxious, maybe, more sensitive. I guess all I was feeling was that I was different. Sometimes I'll be at work or a party and get that same feeling. I am not like these people. I don't know what I'm doing here. And it comforts me to know that I felt that way as a child, too. Maybe that should make me feel worse, but it makes me calm and resolved. I've been prepared to be an outsider most of my life. I remember every slight. You've been warned. In fourth grade, I managed to get a good thing going when I discovered the secret to female bonding, the sleepover. 6 girls from school would come over to my house, and we'd roll out sleeping bags in the spare bedroom above the garage. This became a regular thing, and for the first time, I felt like I had a steady group of friends. Even if my attempts at social interaction throughout the school week became awkward and tiresome, by Friday, it was sleepover time again, and all was forgiven. One weekend, I went out of town for a dance recital, and when I came back, I was informed that a sleepover had taken place without me. Apparently, since my house hadn't been an option, Tori had offered to host. Tori wasn't in the group, but she'd seen her opportunity to usurp me, and she took it. I didn't like Tori. Tori was mean. If I'd known what was good for me, I would have just shut up and accepted that we could alternate weekends. Maybe I'd even have to invite her over from now on, but that would be a small price to pay for true friendship. Sadly, my sense of justice would not allow me to make this sacrifice. I'd rather be right than happy. I reminded the girls that we, as a group, didn't like Tori, that she was a bully. But no one listened. The next day on the playground, I was standing in line for the monkey bars, thinking about what I would say if I ever met the cast of Boy Meets World, and then I was on the ground. Fuzzy black stars appeared and dissolved in slow motion, and when my vision came back, I felt a choking sensation. I was being dragged across the gravel by the collar of my army jacket. Tori! I scratched and clawed at her, but she was big for our grade. She towed me across the playground and under the slide. When I was put on my feet, I stood in front of a tribunal of the sleepover gang, who were standing in over-the-top indignant poses. The slide on this particular playground was flanked by a wooden climbing wall. A normal wall with an old rope on it. So when you were underneath it, you had a degree of privacy. Students had taken to scratching their initials into the backside of the wall's soft wood, which gave this dark corner of the playground a kind of menacing Victorian asylum quality. Something new was there. Haphazardly written in some kind of magic marker were the words, "Mary D. is a jerk." In fact, as my eyes began to adjust, I saw that hastily scrawled insults about almost every girl in our group now adorned the wall. Based on the manner in which I'd been summoned to this meeting, I knew what was coming. I tried to protest. I didn't do it. I was their friend. I mean, Mary D. is a jerk. Amanda sucks. Why would I write a bunch of mean stuff about my friends, using such generic insults? I noticed how high the writing was placed and rushed towards the wall to demonstrate that I couldn't have done it. I wasn't even tall enough. Surely they could see that. Once I started to reach my arm up, though, it looked like I would be able to make it if I got up on my toes. I made a big show of flailing my hand just beneath the writing, but kept my heels firmly on the ground, as though I was the kind of person who couldn't balance otherwise. This was a setup. I suggested alternative suspects. I tried to look as outraged for my friends as they were themselves. I knew it was Tori. It was so obvious I couldn't believe I'd even have to say it. But she was tall, and I was outnumbered, so I wasn't about to accuse her then and there. Once we were back in the classroom and under the safety of adult supervision, I made the rounds to each girl. I whispered that it had to be Tori, that she was trying to squeeze me out, that they were giving her exactly what she wanted. Sadly, by this time, they were enjoying their dramatic game of cold shoulder too much. It would have spoiled their fun to stop hating me. The next day I regrouped. Sure, I was starting to hate them right back, but I'd been wronged and this would not stand. I doubled down on the too short angle, took a ruler outside at recess and recorded the results. The measurements were shoddy, but what my evidence lacked in accuracy, it made up for in volume. That's how you save a friendship. Comprehensive documentation. I also pointed out that defacing property was not in my nature. I'd read about the disappearing beaches in National Geographic Kids, and my anxiety about the environment went through the roof, so I did not condone waste, littering, or graffiti. I even argued that the use of the word suck should have eliminated me from suspicion because I was against swearing. Oh, sweet, naive younger me. They would not be moved. The harder I tried to prove my innocence, the more I revealed my true nature, and eventually their motivation for shunning me transformed. It became less about the alleged betrayal, and more about their aversion to hyperactive little weirdos. They'd moved on from being angry and settled into just not liking me. This is how supervillains are created. My double life. Origin story. There was a small window in my early childhood when I wanted to be a doctor. This was inspired by my pediatrician, a relatively young man whom I called Dr. Handsome. I had assumed this was because his name was Dr. Hansen or Dr. Branson, but I recently found out his name was Dr. Ritger, so I guess I should have just died at age 4 when I decided to call my physician Dr. Handsome without so much as a pun to justify it. Anyway, I loved Dr. Handsome. All I actually knew about him was he was nice and he helped people, but he got a lot of attention for it, which seemed like a pretty sweet gig. When I grow up, I'm going to be a poor doctor, I announced. My mom asked what I meant. I'm going to be a doctor for poor people. They won't need to pay. I'll work for free. My mom's a sucker for this kind of sweet little kid stuff, but she had to point out I might face complications in adult life, even if it meant crushing my dream. That's very nice, sweetheart, but if you work for free, what will you do for money? My mom was an accountant and the breadwinner of the family, so teaching her children about money was the responsible thing to do. She may have even wondered if my brother or I would follow in her footsteps. I thought about this for a while. I'd just been served a heavy dose of reality. Oh, I said, I can't believe you didn't think of this yourself, Mom. If I run out of money, I'll just write a check. She knew then that a career in finance was not for me. Aside from becoming martyr MD, I didn't have many career goals before I decided I wanted to perform. Sometimes this worries me. Am I like one of those Chinese gymnasts who's known nothing but this life, never able to consider another option? Am I going to wake up in 10 years and say, someone get me to a lab, I've got some shit to discover? I would actually love that. Having zero education to back up that desire would be irritating, but going to college at 40 with a background in the arts and discovering the competitive world of science would be a terrible movie. Terrible screenplay idea number one. Terrible title ideas include, but are not limited to, The Science of Art. The Art of Science. Old maid in a lab coat. Still, performing is all I've cared about since the first time I can remember caring about anything. I don't know how you pursue acting as an adult. It's possible that the process would have subjected me to more discouraging situations than I could handle, and I would have bailed and started a closet organizing business while letting my own life and home fall into chaos. Terrible screenplay idea number two. Terrible title ideas include, but are not limited to, Closet Case. Organize This. Mothballs and Heartbreak. Love Hoarder. I'm glad I got started early. It's all Mike's fault. There are plenty of early influences I could point to. Newsies, Life with Mikey, everything Bette Midler ever did. But my brother Mike claims I started performing because I wanted to copy him, which is absolutely true. My brother is my hero. I've idolized him since the day I was born, and I still do. He's responsible for at least 60% of my personality, for better or worse. I'm told that if you're an only child, you grow up thinking you're the center of the universe, and if you have tons of siblings, you grow up with a healthy perspective on how small you are in the grand scheme of things. I like to think that my brother told me I was a worthless brat often enough that I got the same effect. Our dad had been an athlete in college and exposed the two of us to every team sport Maine had to offer. The poor man got so excited when we showed the slightest aptitude for sports, only to have his hopes dashed when we gave them up just as quickly. The summer I played t-ball, I got in trouble for blowing kisses to my friend Margaret Eddy, the first baseman for the other team. Soccer didn't appeal to me at all. I stood in the middle of the field for the entirety of the one game I played. The other kids had the ball. I'd wait my turn. Most important, my brother had no real interest in sports, and I wasn't about to waste my time doing something where I couldn't follow him around. Mike's main interests were watching Star Wars, playing Magic the Gathering, and avoiding his annoying little sister. The only time he happily included me was when he wanted to play pro wrestling champions, as I was an ideal partner on whom to inflict moderate injury. At a certain point, he realized that I was sticking around, no matter how often he told me that I was adopted and should run away. He reluctantly accepted that he would have to put up with my pestering questions and should probably try to ameliorate my lameness in the process. I asked him what Cypress Hill meant by tell Bill Clinton to go and inhale, and he rolled his eyes and made the international sign for smoking weed by pressing his thumb and forefinger to his lips. I nodded like I understood, which I did not. 2 years later, I asked him what Alanis Morissette meant by go down on you in a theater. He let out a sigh that communicated, you are such a loser for wanting to know this stuff, and you're an even bigger loser for not knowing it already. And then made the international sign for blowjob by pumping his fist in front of his mouth and pulling a slack-jawed, idiotic expression. You know, like all girls do when they're giving a blowjob. I nodded, like I understood, which again I did not. He protected me, too. When I was 10, our dentist needed to take impressions of my teeth. To do this, the bored dental hygienist stuck a mold in my mouth that felt like it was the size of a grapefruit and told me to stay still for about 2 minutes. I tried using hand signals to protest that I was about to choke and die. She rolled her eyes and told me to breathe through my nose. When I vomited all over the station, she started screaming at me, but at least she took the mold out and I could draw enough breath to start crying. Mike was having his checkup in the next room and rushed over to me. Then my 12-year-old brother marched out and told our dentist that he was going to kill him. Deep down, he loves me. When we were really little, Mike showed me a neat trick that he called drama. He screamed as loud as he could, and when our babysitter ran into the room in a panic, he said, just drama. And thus, the seed was planted. When he was 7, I followed his lead again. Mike enrolled in dance classes because he wanted to learn to rap dance, which probably meant however Vanilla Ice was dancing. After his first lesson, he came home in a pair of baggy neon pants with a geometric neon pattern, knowing how to do the running man. For the first time, I knew the cold sting of being the biggest loser on the planet. I cried to my parents that I wanted to take dance lessons, too. My parents were bona fide masters of letting us think that we were in control, especially when it came to keeping the peace between my brother and me. They presented me with the option of taking tap and ballet, which meant prettier costumes, and I agreed that hip-hop class with a bunch of boys did not sound like the best fit for me. Had it not been for Mike and Vanilla Ice and those baggy neon pants, I might never have discovered my calling. Little Orphan Anna. At 5, I had a plump face and dirty blonde curls, and people would often tell my parents that I looked like Shirley Temple. I knew nothing about Shirley Temple, but she's like me, you say? Well, she must be marvelous. I adore Shirley Temple. My dance teacher said the same thing when I started classes with her, and once I revealed my secret power to grind dance classes to a halt by randomly singing at the top of my lungs, she suggested that I sing the Shirley Temple classic On the Good Ship Lollipop at the recital. Tap ballet and a solo performance? I was stretched so thin, but my public demanded it. Incidentally, Shirley Temple made like 7 movies at the age of 6, which is straight up child abuse, but kind of badass. The recital was just your run-of-the-mill clusterfuck. Children screaming and running around backstage at a local high school auditorium. My big number was going brilliantly until halfway through the second verse when I got to the bit about landing in a chocolate bar. It was my favorite part, and I gave that mediocre piece of wordplay the kind of hammy treatment that would have made the overworked Miss Temple proud. Lesson. If you start congratulating yourself mid-performance, you are about to screw up. I forgot the next lyrics. I stood on stage with my mouth open while the adults in the front row tried to get me back on track. I weighed my options, and while it didn't occur to me to simply leave the stage, I devised this impromptu exit strategy. Slowly slide my feet farther and farther apart, then let gravity take over until eventually I face plant in slow motion on the stage. I hoped I would wake up in bed. I hoped someone would come scoop me up and take me to Dunkin' Donuts. But that didn't happen. The pre-recorded accompaniment did not stop. After a while, I sat back up, and when the chorus came back around, I started singing again, red-faced and with far less conviction. The song ended, and I walked off stage to where my mom was waiting for me. I said, well, that was stupid. My mom tells this story with affection, I suppose because I shook it off. I didn't say I wanted to quit. I wasn't afraid to show my face after messing up. She probably should have been a little worried about that reaction, though. What a little sociopath, right? The following year, in spite of my disastrous debut performance, my dance teacher suggested that I audition for some local theater. Our community theater was run down but very charming, and they were about to put on a production of Annie, which is going to come up a lot in my childhood. My apologies. In preparation, I watched the 1982 film version of Annie with my family, and my world exploded. These girls were dancing, singing, causing trouble, and playing with dogs. I needed this to be my life. I was too young to play Annie, but I wanted to play the part of Molly desperately. Molly is the young orphan who Annie comforts with the song Maybe. It's a pretty heartbreaking piece of music, and I wanted to get in there and chew some of that depressing scenery. Alas, they went a different direction for Molly, but I got to play Tessie. The internet informs me that Tessie is 10 years old while Molly is 6, but in our version, Tessie was the littlest orphan. Tacking on any superlative is a surefire way to get a kid excited about something, so it was a clever way to convince me that Tessie was a special character. However, Tessie really should be the littlest orphan. What kind of 10-year-old has a catchphrase like, oh my goodness, they're fighting and I won't get no sleep all night. Get your shit together, Tessie. Doing the show was the best. I was in heaven. Being tiny was a good thing. Being loud was a good thing. In everything else I'd done in my 6 years on Earth, I'd been told I had too much energy, but here I had somewhere to channel it all. We sang It's the Hard Knock Life. We did a dance with tin buckets and scrub brushes that was bursting with adorable, scrappy rage. We got to embody the rollicking fun of being orphans. Why are kids so obsessed with orphans? We got to play with a dog. At one point, the director told the girls we were being too rough with the dog and they should play with me instead because it might tire me out a little, so maybe I still had too much energy. They're adding a tap number. Let's go learn it! To this day, seeing a tattered brown cardigan or a pair of thin-soled lace-up boots makes my heart sing. In a costume context, not like on a person. I'm not some out-of-touch monster who sees real-world poverty and longs for the days of her musical theater beginnings. One review mentioned me. The reviewer said something nice but remarkably unspecific, yet my mother and father know that sentence verbatim to this day. I won't bother pretending I think that's lame of them. I mean, it is, I just don't think that it is. 'Cause my parents loving and supporting me is a pretty sweet situation, as parent-child relationships go. My next local gig was playing Baby June in a production of Gypsy a few towns away. The director was a woman with enormous black hair who seemed to bathe in knockoff Chanel No. 5 and tacky jewelry. I'd never met someone who was so unapologetic about how they looked. She sparkled like a Christmas disco ball at all times. If I'd known what a drag queen was, I would have thought, that woman looks like a female drag queen, and chuckled to myself about my very first piece of lazy observational humor. Instead, I thought, that woman is all the colors of the rainbow, and I want to roll around in her closet. She turned out to be all business when it came to this production, and no, I would not be allowed to use a trick baton. I would learn to twirl the batons, because that's what professionals do. And don't put your hand there, put it 2 centimeters to the left, and learn right from left, Anna. The day I cried because I realized that Dainty June, the slightly older version of my character, was played by a different actress, she said, yes, that's right, so let's rehearse the transition number again. Dig your own grave, little one. Okay, she didn't say the dig your own grave part, but she was not sympathetic. With our ruthless and bejeweled director at the helm, the Biddeford City Theater production of Gypsy was actually pretty good. Looking back, I've wondered why she was so demanding. It was just community theater. Why did it have to be so perfect? But I've also now been around enough people who have a low opinion of anyone who's creative in a non-professional realm to know that that's ugly and ignorant. People don't have to do things by half measure because they aren't getting paid for it. In fact, that's all the more reason to throw every ounce of passion you have behind it. I think she could have yelled a bit less for the sensitive types like me who need to be told they're wonderful every half hour to accomplish anything at all, but I respect that she pushed herself and everyone around her. The show paired me with my onstage sister, aka my default new best friend. Virginia was an unsuspecting tomboy with maybe 8 months on me, which was a lifetime of experience. She was unaware that we were going to be best friends, but after a while I wore her down and she introduced me to the excitement of the occult. The theater we were in was this beautiful 1890s opera house, and we played with a Ouija board in the balcony between rehearsals. She told me stories about Helen, the ghost that haunted the theater, and how if we played with the Ouija board too often, Satan would have enough power to bring Helen back from the dead and destroy us all. 'Cause kids are dark. We stayed in touch for a while after the show, mostly because Virginia was very excited about becoming someone's pen pal. At her suggestion, we promised to write each other letters, and as the show came to a close, she began to add more and more detail to her plan for our epistolary adventures. She said we could enclose small items like beads we find, and smear the paper with our current favorite lipstick and circle it to ask, "What do you think of this shade?" The level of specificity rattled me. Even at 8, I could tell this was a contrivance based on something she'd read in a book or seen in a movie. In her first letter to me, I found a handful of beads and a smear of lipstick. I still enjoyed the letters, and I tried to participate in the suggested spirit of her requests without doing exactly what she'd described. I sent her shells from the beach by my grandparents' house and pictures that I cut out of magazines. She sent her next letter with nothing inside, and we volleyed for a few more weeks until it petered out. Don't try to participate in someone else's idea of what's supposed to happen in a relationship. You will fail. The show also introduced a dangerous new concept to my family. Gypsy and the main character of Mama Rose explore the effects of the stage parent on both child and mother. My parents immediately saw in Mama Rose a blueprint of everything they wanted to avoid. We hadn't met any stage parents in real life yet, but if I was going to be playing around with this theater thing for a year or two, little did they know. No one in my family was going to push anyone into doing anything. And for the next decade, my parents went on high alert for signs that I wanted to stop. I think they might still be waiting. Maybe that's why my mom is always telling me she loves me because I'm a good person, or whatever. Early bird. I get embarrassed about being a child actor. Probably because I spent a lot of time around child actors when I was one. They're crazy. When people ask me how I got started, I'll usually make some crack about how I was one of those freaky kid actors and how all that's missing is the drug problem. I want to get in front of the story so I can control it. Maybe people don't have judgmental feelings about child actors. I just worry that it conjures images of pushy parents or tiny diva hissy fits or Star Search. Okay, I did audition for Star Search, but I didn't get on the show, so I hope you're happy. At 10, I stood in a modest office in Manhattan and sang Tomorrow from Annie, I warned you, for a children's talent agent. That was basically it. That's all I had to do. That and cry in the lobby beforehand because I got nervous and my mom had to remind me that my cousin Tina wasn't going to get married 30 minutes from New York City every weekend. When I first moved to Los Angeles, occasionally a friend who was struggling would ask me how I got my agent, and telling this story always made me feel like a lucky little jackass. I would try to make the story funny, like I didn't know they were hoping to glean some actionable piece of wisdom out of it. The truth is, I had nothing to offer in the way of advice. Cold call a talent agent, but first be 10 years old? At that age, I didn't have a resume, but I wasn't expected to. At 10, I had a big voice that stood in exponential contrast to my size. I could learn a melody. I didn't sound like a dying cat. I was not one of those kids who started young and never stopped working, and there are many pathetic tales in these pages to prove it. But I'm glad I got my foot in the door at an age when some of the scariest people had to take it easy on me, because I was just a kid. If you're expecting to find advice, I will be no help at all. I have no advice. I do have a truckload of opinions, which I will happily prattle on about to anyone who gives me an opening. I'd just like to add the for entertainment purposes only disclaimer to everything in here, like I'm a psychic hotline or a bot on AshleyMadison.com. I don't know what my parents anticipated happening once I got a fancy agent 4 states away. Maybe they knew that supporting the larger dream when I was a kid was easier than praying it was a phase and begrudgingly supporting me later on. Maybe they only hoped I would book a commercial and get the kind of money that starts a solid college fund in one swoop. That would have been fine with me. I couldn't differentiate between the prestige of a Broadway show and a regional commercial, so I would have been just as happy about becoming an underage corporate stooge. The agency that took me on lined up a few auditions for Broadway shows. The very first one was for Annie. I don't know what to tell you guys. It's just what happened. Then they lined up a handful of commercial auditions. My first auditions for commercials were weird, as were all the ones that would follow. Commercial casting directors were looking for either preternaturally beautiful children or children who were willing to cheese it up so hard they went blue in the face. At that age, I never thought about being pretty. That's not because I was enlightened, it's because I was a little kid, and pretty seemed like an adult criteria. I did think about whether or not I would grow up to be pretty all the time. I asked to see pictures of my grandmother as a young woman. I asked to see pictures of my mother as a young woman. I found out my mother's side of the family was universally flat-chested, so I asked if my deceased paternal grandmother had anything better going on back in the day. I was a ladylike and sensitive child. As for the cheese factor, I was no better off. This was the origin of my aversion to child actors. Most of them were fucking weirdos. Bunch of precocious extroverts who were learning to kiss adults' asses and say things like, "How old do you want me to be?" I was a loud, hyperactive loser, but I was self-aware enough to know that would make me look like a dick. Perhaps because my family's emotional range spanned from composed to stoic, I was not trying to play ball. For all the trouble I'd been in my life for having too much energy, I could not figure out why I was supposed to be excited about tangle-free shampoo. My hair was always tangled, and I was doing just fine, thank you very much. Kids in these audition waiting rooms were unlike anything I'd seen before. They'd make a big show of running up to other kids they knew and saying things like, "I haven't seen you since we outgrew the Music Man tour." They'd humble brag about the last commercial they booked or how they'd screen tested for a TV pilot last week, and their sleazy managers would say, "Our little Porsche's a booking machine." Usually my mom or dad was with me in these waiting rooms. My mom was always kind and wonderful, but like me, my mom's a people pleaser and a rule follower. We were at a professional audition. I would go in with my headshot and resume and try my best, and she would be the supportive parent who accompanies, but does not pressure, her child. My dad had far less patience. He was my stoic life vest. He's the smartest person I know, not the smartest person I've ever met. I've met Dr. Oz and Dakota Fanning, but the smartest person I can call on the phone. He's an incredible resource, but it's also very frustrating. It's like having Stephen Fry for a father. He makes you feel like an idiot just by breathing. Like my mom, he wanted to make his children feel loved and wanted, but he's almost painfully Irish, so repression's more in his wheelhouse. The only time I've ever seen him cry was when he described the plot of the film Rudy to me. The unnerving thing was that I didn't even realize he was crying for a good 10 minutes. At first, it just seemed like he had allergies or he'd eaten some spicy food. Aside from the tears, there was no other indication that he was emotional. Sometimes I'd sit there surrounded by kids loudly going over their one line of dialogue with parents chatting about which voice coach they were going to use now that Mrs. Ilanova had taken on too many students and wasn't giving little Teresa the kind of personalized attention she really needed to flourish, and I'd feel myself start to spiral. I wouldn't just wonder if I belonged there. I'd descend into big question territory. Is this what everyone outside of Maine is like? Is this what the future will be like? Is this what actors are like? Is this what I'm like? I would turn my head maybe 15 degrees, and my dad would be staring straight ahead. And then, as if he'd been waiting for me, he'd throw me a look. "These people are freaks. Let's get this over with, get the hell out of here, and get a Hostess cupcake from the rest stop on the way home." It felt like coming up for air. It only took a few months before my agent mercifully realized that I sucked at commercial auditions. They decided I should start coming in only for theater, which made me very happy. Not because as a 10-year-old from Maine with no experience, I thought I was too good for anything, but because professional auditions were in New York, which meant that one of my parents had to take time off work, drive me 6 hours to the city for an audition that usually lasted 10 minutes, and then drive me 6 hours back. Yes, you are correct. What my parents did for me was crazy, and I'll never be able to repay them as long as I live. I had my first successful audition at age 12 for a musical called High Society, although when I arrived, I assumed it was not going to go well. In the waiting room, I was struck by the uniformity of dress. The character was from a rich family, and my competitors looked the part. How did a girl aged 10 to 14 even come by a sweater set? Weren't those available exclusively to toddlers and women over 60? The audition room was long and mirrored and had creaky wooden floors. I gave my sheet music to the pianist in the corner and turned to face a small row of people sitting behind a folding table at the far end of the room. "Whoa, whoa. Let me look at your nails, young lady." Legendary casting director Jay Binder, who would become my greatest champion, was motioning me forward. My nails were forest green with gold stars, which was pretty unusual, especially on a child in the days before Pinterest chic nail art. I walked up to show him, unsure if I was in trouble or about to be told how wonderful I was. "I got them done in Florida. I was visiting my grandparents for Thanksgiving, and my mom took me to a nail place." "Your mother let you get green nails?" I nodded. "Pretty cool, Mom. All right. What are you going to sing for us, honey?" I walked back to the center of the room with a great gift. Jay Binder had said, "Come up here. We're not scary. We want you to do well. Cute nails. Now please go do something impressive." Almost every audition that has gone well in my life started with something like this. A week later, I was told to come back and audition for the director and producers. Mike and Anna take New York. As supportive as they were, my parents were looking for a way to get me to New York without relying on them for transportation, since they enjoyed having jobs and paying bills and other accoutrements of middle-class survival. By this time, my brother was 14, and they deemed him perfectly capable of accompanying his 12-year-old sister on a bus to New York. So that's what we started doing. People who grew up in major cities may wonder why the hell I would act like it's a big deal to be unaccompanied in New York City at that age. It's populated with both adults and children. It's a functioning metropolis. Kevin McAllister was only 10 in Home Alone 2, Lost in New York, and that kid saved Christmas. Conversely, people from suburban areas act like my parents sent me wandering around the site of the Baby Jessica well, blindfolded and holding a flaming baton. So, pick a side, and prepare to judge me either way. My parents bought a couple of bus tickets, and my brother and I got ready for our day trip. We packed extra batteries for our Walkman, the family cell phone for emergencies, two Lunchables, and this time, drum roll, I wore a cardigan. I was totally going to look the part. The one cardigan I owned was chunky and black with a jewel-tone pattern that looked so much like jet fighters from the Star Wars universe, I referred to it as my X-Wing sweater. I paired it with wide-leg jeans and black lace-up boots with thick rubber soles. How classy was I? When my callback went well, I was asked to come in again the next day. This put a small wrinkle in our plan since my brother and I only had the clothes on our backs and a bunch of dead batteries, and by the way, we needed to get back to Port Authority by 4 p.m. or we would miss our connecting bus in Boston. Naturally, we told them it would be no problem, and we were looking forward to coming in again the next day. My parents had given us about $40, so they faxed a copy of their credit card to a squalid hotel and convinced the hotel manager that although their children were checking in now, they themselves, of course, would be along later that day. What kind of children would be staying in a hotel room in New York City alone? The next morning, against our parents' explicit orders, we went out in search of the Village, specifically Bleecker and McDougal. Our dad had talked about that corner with affection and awe, and we could see why. Each corner of the intersection had a cafe that looked like something we'd only seen in movies. My dad probably meant, like, the music scene in the 60s, but we shared a plate of pancakes and figured life would never get better than this. None of those cafes are there anymore, and I don't want to sound like one of those people who complains, oh, New York has changed so much, it isn't what it used to be, except that that is a lie. I have always wanted to be one of those people, and now I am! After our adventure, we went to my second callback. I could tell it was going well because they were keeping me in the room for a long time. This is the only metric I have. I black out in auditions, even to this day. As my brother and I left, an assistant jogged after us. She caught up to us at the elevator and said, "You're doing great, and we want to bring you back in again tomorrow." She swallowed and lowered her voice. "But we were wondering if you had anything else to wear? Maybe we could see you in some nicer shoes or something?" Instead of saying, "No, bitch, I came down here on a bus and washed my socks and underwear in the hotel sink this morning," we assured her that we were all over it. No problem. Message received. I had no idea what they were looking for, but I knew that no matter what a casting director said, you were supposed to agree and figure it out later. It was dark out when we left the casting office, so we decided to wake up early the next day to buy some respectable shoes with what was left of our cash. The next morning, we asked the receptionist at the hotel where to find the nearest Payless. At this point in our program, I'd like to gently remind anyone who thought that was a punchline to check yourself. Finding respectable shoes for girls at Payless is perfectly normal for lots of families. I mention it by name in this story because it makes me feel sentimental, not because it's supposed to be ironic. And to the people hearing this thinking, We already knew it was normal. You don't need to be so preachy. I apologize. I have been around rich people too long, and it has made me defensive. It took almost all morning and into the afternoon to find a pair of shoes that looked dressy but left us with enough cash to get McDonald's before we caught the bus home. Eventually, we found a pair of white strappy sandals that were a size too big, but they were on sale, so they were coming with me. I slipped them on with my wide-leg jeans and ratty sweater and thought, I've done it. I look like a rich girl. I still looked like a delinquent who didn't know how to brush her hair, but now I had white shoes. I went to my final audition. I blacked out. We caught the bus home. My brother and I kept repeating that I shouldn't get too excited. I shouldn't count my chickens. I was 12, but I'd experienced enough rejection that I had a system in place for managing my expectations. Somewhere around Hartford, we turned on the four emergencies phone. I had a voicemail saying I got the job. We celebrated for however long it takes a busload of people to wake up and scream at you. Jaded Old Chorus Girl. I lost a Tony Award to Broadway legend Otter McDonald when I was 12, so I've been a bitter bitch since before my first period. I'm very proud to have lost that Tony to Ms. McDonald. She's one of the finest talents in the theater world and genuine Broadway royalty. I also feel that if I had won and made a televised speech at age 12, the delayed embarrassment would have been so severe I'd currently be a Howard Hughes-style shut-in, but without the money for the mansion or the planes or the legion of servants to take away bottles of my urine. Starting in theater gave me a basic work ethic that I may not have gotten if I started in film and television. I worked 6 days a week, 8 shows a week. That's 2 shows on Wednesdays and Saturdays, Mondays off. It wasn't so much the schedule. I worked in accordance with child labor laws. It was that I was held accountable for my work. Once, during rehearsal, our director was playing with the shape of a musical number that involved most of the cast. Which jokes should stay, where they should go, etc. He decided to try reinstituting a small joke that I'd had in a previous draft, and we started the number again from the top. I lost where we were in the music, and I opened my mouth to say the line a measure too late. He was already shaking his head and signaling the pianist to stop. Anna just lost a line. Let's go back to how it was before and start again. Okay. Those are the rules, and I will operate within them from now on. I'll just double my memorization efforts, pretend I'm not crying, and see you all again tomorrow. Beyond tutoring breaks every 3 hours, I didn't get special treatment. When I booked High Society, it was unclear how long I would be in New York. My contract was for 6 months, but shows can go under after a few weeks of poor ticket sales. Since my dad was a substitute teacher at the time, he was able to move to New York with me, and my mother stayed in Maine with my brother. We rented an apartment in Yonkers. We is accurate. He signed the rental agreement, but I was the one who paid for it, and commuted into the city each day. Yonkers was not very glamorous, but it was cheaper, and I was being paid the union minimum. When you're from Maine and you get a job on Broadway, you take what they offer. Between my accountant mother and my former banker father, I'm sure a budget was worked out, but by the time the show was in tech rehearsals, it was clear to my dad that it was not manageable. I have no idea if my dad had been planning to say something, but one day when he was dropping me off at rehearsal, the producer walked past us and casually asked, "How are things, Will?" "Well, Michael, not good." My dad's plain spoken. It's a wonderful quality that I feel lucky to have inherited and that has gotten me in trouble more times than I can count. When my daughter is grown, she can make the decision to starve for her art. She can live in a one-bedroom apartment with 5 people and work a second job during the day, but we aren't going to be able to make this work any longer, and I'm going to take her home unless we figure something out. The ultimate negotiation tactic, be willing to walk away. I certainly wasn't willing, but my dad was, and as he said, I wasn't grown, and it wasn't my decision. The producers agreed to give me a weekly per diem, and that kept us afloat while we were in New York. When the show closed, I had nothing left over, but I won the final $5 Friday draw and went home with around $250 in cash. Each bill had the name of a cast or crew member written on it, and I cherished them. I vowed never to spend them. When I got to high school, I started dipping into my stash whenever someone's older sister would buy us booze until the bills were all gone. I know. It's all so little girl lost. It wasn't a financial win, but the experience was incredible. The show was based on the movie musical High Society with Grace Kelly, which was based on the movie and stage play The Philadelphia Story with Katharine Hepburn. The plot centers on a woman who's about to marry the wrong man and the complications that arise the weekend before her wedding. I played the woman's little sister. I had a bunch of solid lines, a funny musical number, and a great piece of physical comedy in the second act that only once drew blood mid-performance. The cast and crew were sweet beyond words. They were encouraging and serious, and they believed in me. They told me to stay focused on dance lessons despite my apparent lack of aptitude, held half-serious competitions for crying on cue, and recommended movies and books they felt smart young women should know. Lisa Baines, who played my mother, would lightly bounce along to the music before our entrance and whisper in an old-timey voice, "Let's go do a great big Broadway show." How great is that? They treated me like I was family and wanted to make sure that my real family was okay under the stress of one parent moving to New York. Once a month, my dad and I would drive home to Maine after the Sunday matinee and make it back in time for the Tuesday night show. On those days, the entire cast would speed up their dialogue and cut off every laugh a moment too soon so that I could beat traffic. Only one cast member indulged in languid pauses during those performances, and our conductor, Paul Gemignani, would punish her by radically speeding up the tempo of her songs. One of my closest friends asked me recently if I had a favorite memory from my career. I do, but it's not my own. It's one of those stories I was told so often that I can picture it as clearly as if I were there. The only reason I'm certain I wasn't is because I was on stage at the time. The first time my mom came to visit, my dad snuck her into the alley just outside the stage door and told her to listen. "They're almost done. That's the curtain call music." He leaned in a little closer to the door and held up a finger. They listened quietly. Suddenly the applause swelled. "That's for her." My mom burst into tears. I love this story. Luckily, most of the stuff that made my mom proud didn't revolve around me performing. I hit the jackpot. I didn't have to go to school, my dad was tutoring me, and I got to run around New York City all day. Sometimes I was lonely. I met most of the other kids who were in shows at the time, but as I said, child actors are crazy, and the conversations often looked like this. "Anna Kendrick is a great name. Is that a stage name or your real name?" "It's my real name." "You got a good one. Good syllabic symmetry." I'd try to catch my dad's eye and find some recognition that this was not normal pre-adolescent behavior. I did make a few friends. My closest friend was Nora, an understudy in The Sound of Music. The Sound of Music kids were intimidating. They seemed like this sexy co-ed gang, proving once again that even the dorkiest subcultures have their rock stars. Nora was the only thing I had that resembled a normal preteen life. We had sleepovers and went window shopping. We sang along to pop music and show tunes, and each of us tried to convince the other that she was the pretty one. Even though I was friends with Nora, we didn't see each other all the time, and I had no other good friends. Sometimes working and commuting didn't feel as easy as it did other days. I knew the show like the back of my hand, but I still had to do it every night. Sometimes I would get home after a show and I couldn't sleep. I'd sneak into the living room and watch TV until the sun came up. Then I'd sleep all day and dread going to work. I'd dread the drive from Yonkers. I'd dread putting on my costume. I'd dread warming up. I'd dread my entrance. I'd dread my first line. I'd dread my song. I'd dread the drive home. I was so happy to be doing this incredible thing, but at this point, dear listeners, I'd like to use my one, "What do you want from me? I was 12 years old, tired and lonely, and working the kind of job that full-grown adults do," card. I needed a break, just a little one. Anxiety typically only becomes unmanageable for me when I feel I have no choice, when I feel trapped. I just needed a break in routine so I could shake out the dread. One day when we were halfway through the first act, I reached my limit. I needed to take a break right now. Don't get too excited. This isn't a story about me bailing on a Broadway show mid-performance. I told my dad I didn't want to do the show the next night. He knew I wouldn't be asking if I wasn't serious and kind of desperate. At intermission, we went to speak with the stage manager. No, it was a producer, maybe. I remember we were under the stage, but who the hell was in charge of that? Who did you talk to about taking a night off, and why the hell was their office under the stage? At any rate, my dad told the appropriate woman that I was going to stay home and rest the following night. "Well, tomorrow night is tough," she winced. "It would be a lot easier for everyone if you took a night off next week." Just being near a serious conversation between adults made my stomach turn. It still does, actually. And when she looked over at me, she could see that I was upset. "Do you want a glass of water, honey?" In show business, when you tell people that you need something and it runs counter to what they want from you, it's amazing how often they will offer you water. This is code for deal with it. I agreed that having a night off the following week would be just as good. The advance notice would make it less stressful for my coworkers, and I really didn't want anyone to be mad at me. We scheduled my night off for a Tuesday so that coupled with the Monday, which was always off, I would have a real weekend of sorts. My dad took me up to the Catskills. We went to a mall, and I swam in the hotel pool, and I even rode a fat, probably dying horse at a nearby ranch. In the car on the ride home, I was quiet. My dad said, "You really needed that night off when you said you did, huh?" I nodded and he hit the steering wheel. I hated that he was mad, which was weird since he was only mad because he hadn't been able to make me happy. Love is some funny shit, right? When the show closed, I was sad but relieved. I was ready to go home. Still, maybe because I'd seen my family struggle to pay the bills even while my father was working two jobs, it was disconcerting to be unemployed. Sure, I could go home and go to school and see my friends and family, but at what cost? Was I a 12-year-old has-been? I'm still haunted by this fear. It has made me very cautious of feeling comfortable in my career and turned me into a bit of a workaholic. Even now, every job I get, I worry that it will be my last. I think becoming a washed-up hag is sort of my destiny. So if you see a wrinkled old bitch wearing a tattered fur and chain-smoking in an off-Broadway back alley, that's just me. Starting 4 years from now. Hell, thy name is middle school. In elementary school, we had an afternoon of health class once a year. The teacher separated us by gender and explained what we could expect from puberty. They handed out maxi pads to the girls and gave the boys pamphlets on styling a wispy mustache that only grows at the corners of your mouth? I may never know. There was a lot of emphasis on how excited we should be to start our periods. This is a dirty trick, but now I understand why it's necessary. It comes for us all, so there's no point working little girls into a panic over it. However, there was perhaps too much emphasis on the magic of becoming a woman, so much so that I missed a few key points on the logistics of menstruation. For example, I thought that once you got your period, you had it every day, all the time, for the rest of your life. This sounded pretty awful, but the girls on the tampon boxes looked excited about it, and I trusted anyone who could rock a side ponytail. I was also promised an awkward stretch of time when all the girls would tower over the boys. For me, that moment would never come. In middle school, hiding the fact that I still shopped in the kids' section became almost a full-time job. In elementary school, being the smallest was cute. It had given me an identity, even made me feel special. But you know how 13-year-olds don't want to hang out with 8-year-olds? They don't want to hang out with you if you look 8 years old either. My height made me an easy mark. When my sixth grade crush enumerated the reasons he wouldn't date any of the girls in our class, my label was too short. I laughed, then retired to the girls' bathroom where I got on my knees and prayed to Jesus to make me taller. No one in the world was suffering more than me. Once girls started getting boobs, a whole new area of uncreative slams emerged. Hey, Anna, you should date a pirate because they love sunken chests. Where do boys learn these insults? Is there a manual? Is that what they got in health class? When I came back from doing high society, no one my age cared. Despite high society being the 18th longest running Broadway show ever that year. I had hoped my classmates might be impressed, but weirdly, a picture of me in the local paper singing in pigtails did not make me the hit of the school. While no one at Lincoln Junior High especially cared about my New York sabbatical, dance and music classes gave me a level playing field of equally dorky contemporaries to befriend. I even went to overnight choir camp in the summer. I'll say that again in case you weren't already in love with me. Choir camp. It was the only place where I was the cool girl. Well, not cool, maybe, but I stood a chance. It's no surprise, then, that in my professional career, I have played the cool girl character precisely once in Pitch Perfect, a movie about choir. In eighth grade, my crush was the new kid, Daryl. He'd transferred from somewhere exotic that I remember being New York or Chicago, but was probably Canada. On his first day, a girl in gym class got hit hard with a basketball and dropped to the ground holding her head. We all stood there with our mouths open, but Daryl scooped her up like it was nothing and carried her to the nurse's office. The kid ran heroically to her aid, like an adult in a movie. Why couldn't that head injury have been mine? One day, a girl asked me, in front of Daryl, what size my pants were. Middle school was the time when kids asked each other all kinds of inappropriate questions, and if you didn't answer, you were the weird one. She was trying to expose me as a genetic freak, still forced to shop at the Limited 2 because of my undersized arms, legs, and everything else. Guess what, haters? I'd been shopping that very weekend. Jesus, take the wheel! I'd been to Wet Seal, which was trashy, but at least it wasn't a store for children, and I found a pair of jeans that I didn't have to pin in the back. I shrugged and said, a small, I guess. Don't you mean a children's size 12? She turned to Daryl. She still shops at, like, Gap Kids. I didn't. Gap Kids was too expensive. Oh, you stupid bitch. No, they're from Wet Seal, I said, pulling out the tag to prove their origin. Yeah, it's a 0, I guess. It's a 00, she pointed out, still trying to shame me. Today, I assume she passes her time flaying old ladies for sport. In a flash, I realized I could say, so, are girls not supposed to have small waists? No, Daryl said. That's proper. I had abruptly crossed over into a land where being small was a good thing. And Daryl had spoken 4 words to me. Suck it, you crone! It should be noted that a 00 was a good fit for a 13-year-old girl who was so painfully underdeveloped she didn't get her period for another 3 years. If you aren't a size 00, congratulations, you don't look 10 anymore. That was the best interaction I ever had with Daryl. I figured I'd take that little seedling and let it blossom, hit my stride once we got to high school and I, fingers crossed, got boobs. I'd play the long game. Alas,